Okay, everyone, we're going to get started. So if you take your seats, please. All right, first I want to introduce Victor Chan, one of our Dominican delegates, who is working with Region 3, which is the Great Lakes region. So those of you from the Great Lakes, you will know Victor, and you'll be seeing him later. So Victor, please welcome.
Hi. So we are honored to have with us today the California Secretary of State, Alex Padilla. Secretary Padilla's life story is similar to many of our peers and some of us in this room. His parents immigrated to the United States and raised their family in a working class community, doing as much as they could to provide good life for their children. Now, growing up, he attended local public high schools and in the LA area, and eventually went on to graduate from MIT with a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. And then returned to Southern California to work for Hughes Aircraft, but not for long. At age 26, Padilla was elected to the LA City Council to represent the same East San Fernando Valley community where he grew up. And in 2001, his colleagues elected him to the first of three terms as council president, becoming the youngest member and the first Latino to serve in this capacity. In 2006, Padilla was elected to the California State Senate, and over the next 8 years, he fought to protect Californians through groundbreaking legislative initiatives that included mandating nutritional labeling on menus, smoke-free housing and increased penalties for illegally selling tobacco to minors, and laws that criminalize the transfer, sale, or possession of illicit cell phones in prison in order to curb gang violence in communities. Secretary Padilla's contributions to education were equally impressive. First, he saw the need to support English learners in California public schools. He authored a series of legislative measures to identify and implement best practices in English learner curriculum and instruction statewide. Padilla wrote the law that streamlined the transfer process and created a clear and consistent pathway for community college students working to transfer to the CSU system. He has also authored the law that requires California's elite university athletic programs to provide alternative scholarships to student athletes who lose their athletic scholarships due to injury. Secretary Padilla previously served as president of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, NALEO, the nonpartisan organization made up of more than 6,000 federal, state, and local officials dedicated to all aspects of civil engagement. We are honored here to have with us today and share his story and help guide us in this important initiative. Please welcome College Debate 16, California Secretary of State, Alex Padilla.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here with you. Now, I know that there's a strong Dominican delegation here today, but that there's you're representing a lot of colleges and universities from throughout the country, and it's great that you're coming together, not just for an important conversation, but at an important time. So most of the other states have already had their primary election, right? But in California, this Tuesday coming up is our presidential primary election, and around the state, people are either dropping off their vote-by-mail ballots in the mailbox, or they're making their plan for where they're going to go vote and what time they're going to go vote on Tuesday. And so as we're all going to be watching CNN or some channel to wait for the results, it's going to be one of the last big final steps in determining who the nominees are as we're getting ready for November. And I know that's a big part of why you're here, because you're getting the training, you're getting the information for how we can go back home and make an impact, and make an impact amongst young people who maybe they're registered, maybe they're not registered yet. You're going to take care of that. But we've got to make sure we get as many people voting in November as possible. It's great to be inspired to do this by helping elect the next president of the United States. But there's a lot more reasons for why it's important and why I'm here to thank you for your interest, for your commitment, and for what you're doing. And I'm going to do so in part by filling in a little bit more of my background. Because I'll be honest with you, standing here before you today, as the California Secretary of State, or even just me being in politics and in government, is the last thing I thought I'd be doing when I was growing up. And one of the last things I thought I'd be doing even when I was in high school and even when I was in college, to be honest. Because usually when I talk to a group of students, I start off my talk with a little survey. And I'll ask it today, just knowing that the results are going to be just a little bit different. All right, my survey is this. Raise your hand if you like politics. All right, see, most crowds, you can imagine, most hands don't go up. All right, now I'm going to ask you another question that's a little bit different, but similar, but different. Raise your hand if you like politicians. Oh, come on, where's all the hands? All right, no, I know, it's okay if you didn't raise your hand, because what usually comes to mind, not for you, but at least maybe some of your friends, when you hear the term politics or politicians, right? You can imagine, give me here some answers. When you hear politics, politicians, what usually comes to mind? Corruption, whoa. All right, let's keep going with that one. What else? Liars, greed. All right. Look, it's what I used to think when I was in high school, when I was in college too. So how did I go from thinking that and feeling that to where I am today? Well, I grew up in a neighborhood called Pacoima, California. It's technically part of the city of Los Angeles. It's in an area called the San Fernando Valley, if anybody hears from Southern California. And I'm the son of immigrants. You know, my parents came here in the late 60s from Mexico. They actually came from different parts of Mexico. They met in LA, fell in love, decided to start a family and apply for permanent residency, which they got. And I'm thankful because here I am. They met, they got married, and they had three kids. They have an older sister who has gone from being a teacher to being a principal, and she still works for the LA Unified School District. I have a younger brother who left a career in retail. He now works in government as well. He works for the city of Los Angeles at City Hall. So we're all in public service in some way, shape, or form. And that's not a coincidence given how we were brought up. But I am a middle child, and that may explain a lot of things too. And we're the three kids to our parents who both recently retired just in the last couple of years. My dad retired after nearly 40 years of working in diners around Los Angeles. So if you live in LA and you've ever been to like a Denny's or an IHOP, think of who was scrambling eggs or making sandwiches at noon. That's what my dad did for nearly 40 years. And my mom just retired after nearly 40 years of cleaning houses. And I share that with everybody because I'm proud of my parents. And I also share it because, just think about that, in one generation, my family has gone from being immigrants, cooks and house cleaners, to me. Once upon a time, I was president of the LA City Council, second largest city in America. I was state senator for 8 years, and for six of those 8 years, I chaired the Energy Committee, overseeing all energy, utilities, and communications policy in the state of California. And now I'm the Secretary of State. I oversee the elections in the most populous state in the nation. That's pretty cool in one generation, right? It's for people who think that the American dream is being challenged. Well, it is, but the American dream is alive and well, because I know in my family, if we can come all this way in one generation, that any of you can be anything you want to be when you grow up. There's nothing standing in your way but a lot of hard work. And so that's who's standing here before you today. As was mentioned in the introduction, I was raised in the community of Pacoima. It's a very hardworking class community in Los Angeles. When I was growing up, my favorite subject was math. And so I thought, well, I love math, and somehow I did well in science. All my teachers, my counselors said, you ought to be an engineer, and you ought to look into the school called MIT. And I grew up in love with the beach, and so my college checklist went something like San Diego, Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz. You get the trend here. But I'm glad I applied to MIT, and when that acceptance letter came, I knew it was a chance of a lifetime for me, and really a fulfillment of my parents' dreams. The reason they came to this country, the reason they worked so hard, was to try to let us have a good education and a better life through a better career. And so, anybody here from Massachusetts? All right, I saw the Red Sox hat, man, of course. What school? All right, and? Okay, well, I was right across the river in Cambridge. I spent four winters out there, including the blizzard of 93, and came home with a mechanical engineering degree. And pretty much by then, I realized that, you know what? Crunching numbers and being in front of a computer or in a lab for the next 40 years probably wasn't going to be the life I wanted. And when I came home to California, I came home to a couple of things. You know, I was talking about it on the way in here with somebody. In 1994, in California, there was a measure on the ballot known as Proposition 187. That means you know what Proposition 187 was, right? I booted as well when I was coming home from college. Well, Proposition 187 was, it was a measure in California that would have denied immigrants and children of immigrants public services, which includes, by the way, things like the ability to go to school, things like if you end up in an emergency room, the ability to see a doctor, you know, some very basic stuff. It passed in California. It was challenged in court and eventually thrown out as unconstitutional, but that was the political climate in California at the time. And it may be a shocker, or maybe it's not a shocker. You know, I know this is a nonpartisan effort here, and there's people here from across the political spectrum, but kind of tying that conversation to here today, we're voting on a lot of things here in California on Tuesday. There's local races going on, legislative races going on, congressional, even a U.S. Senate race going on. But clearly what dominates the attention and the news is a campaign for president of the United States. Now, there are some candidates running for president. I won't name names, but these candidates have something to say about immigrants and immigration. And maybe you really agree with what they're saying, or maybe you don't agree with what they're saying and you're frankly offended. Whether you agree with what people are saying, regardless of who the candidate is that you may support, that's an important reason to register and vote, because what they're trying to articulate is their vision and the direction for our country. Or if you disagree with what somebody says, that's a reason to register and vote, because that's how we make our political voice heard in our country, right? We register and we vote. That's how we express ourselves. But in 1994, when I was coming home from college to that environment, thinking, wait, I'm the son of immigrants. What the heck is going on here? Why are certain politicians and elected officials targeting people like me and my family? We work hard, we pay taxes, we're just trying to make a better life. Isn't that what this country is all about? I realized that, you know what? My high school government teacher was right. I may think I'm not interested in politics. I may not agree with what a lot of elected figures and political figures have to say, but if I want to make a difference, if I care about my community and I want to see things get better, I have to get involved, because that's the way we influence and we can change things. Now, where I grew up, I'll be honest, isn't known to most people as being the better part of town. If you look at how schools perform, the schools I went to, if you look at crime rates, if you look at income levels and poverty rates, if you look at air quality or even rates of type 2 diabetes, I had all the factors, all the odds working against me. And again, it was in that time period where I'm debating, well, do I get involved? I feel like I need to, and why is it important? This may mirror some of the conversations that you've had with some of your friends. I realized, why is it that the city officials aren't taking better care of my neighborhood? Why is it that state officials aren't paying more attention and prioritizing issues in my community? Could it be that maybe along with those poverty rates and education attainment levels and everything else, that voter registration rates may be something that people are watching? Or voter turnout rates? And now I've seen it both as a campaign manager, as a staffer, as an elected official, and with so many other titles. Yeah, California is a big state. City of Los Angeles is a big city. And if you can't get everywhere and hear and talk to everyone, is it just human nature that some elected officials may think, well, more people vote over here than over here, will that make a difference? People will say no, because we're elected to represent everybody. But all the public policy challenges that I see, if I map them out, and voter registration and turnout rates, if I map them out, there's a clear consistency going on here. And so, yes, at the age of 21, 22, 23, I decided to get involved and do something about it. And first of all, I really confused my parents, right? Like, wait a minute, you went to school for 4 years, paid how much to get an engineering degree, And now you want to get into politics? He said, trust me, this is important. Trust me, we're going to try to make a difference. And so it just so happened that I was searching for what else to do because, you know, I was leaving engineering in a tough economic time, that I had opportunities to get involved in political campaigns. The very first campaign I got involved with was his dear friend to this day. His name is Tony Cardenas. Went to the same high school. He's about 10 years older than I am. Had a very similar life story and grew up in the same neighborhood. He also got his engineering degree. He's electrical, I'm mechanical, and we figured, you know, if this political stuff doesn't work out, maybe we'll start our own company. But he decided to run for the state legislature in 1995. The election was in 1996. And I thought, well, maybe most politicians are corrupt or greedy or liars or whatever else was said here. But I knew Tony personally, and I knew he was different. And I thought, at least here's one person that I can believe in, that I can have faith in, that is going to do the right thing for the right reasons. And so I started volunteering on his campaign, learning how to, you know, work in my community, registering people to vote, you know, circulating petitions to qualify him for the ballot. And one day he pulled me aside and he said, you know, Alex, I think this campaign is going well, but if I'm going to be serious about this, I'm going to need a full-time campaign manager. Will you do it? And I thought, whoa, I'm pretty young. I just got out of college here. I don't know the first thing about running a campaign. I've never done that before. You know what he told me? He says, that's all right, Alex. I've never run for office before. I don't know what I'm doing either. But we're both smart, we're hardworking, and we're committed to trying to make our community a better place. We can figure this out as we go. And I think we can do this. And so we did. We got to talking to friends and neighbors and asking people to volunteer, to go door to door, to stuff envelopes, to make phone calls. We were organizing before we even knew what organizing was. And he was up against not just one, but two very well-funded and high-profile political figures, people who did very, very good at getting this thing called endorsements and did very good at this other thing called fundraising. And on election day, we won by 20 points. And to me, that was like the biggest lesson and experience of all. If you get involved, you can make a difference. If you get involved and do the work and organize, you can have an influence in who your representatives are, and by extension, what the issues are that are being debated and discussed and acted upon at City Hall, at the state capitol, and even the nation's capitol. How empowering is that? And if you get involved, you realize that as important as it is, as empowering as it is to become a registered voter and to vote in every election, it's even stronger, it's even more powerful when you get others to do the same. Because imagine when you organize your family, your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your community to vote in bigger numbers. That political voice is heard that much louder. And that, at its essence, is how our country is led. The federal level, the state level, and at the local level, you can make a difference, and whether you're running for office or not, officially part of a campaign or not, the results of every election cycle and the actions that come for that term are the direct result of us getting involved or not getting involved, right? So that's what why I do what I do, because, you know, as I started off, like I said, on the campaign side and then working for the legislature and Senator Feinstein before I ever ran for office, for 7.5 years working on the city council, and I can answer questions about filling potholes and stop signs and all the good city stuff. For 8 years working in the state senate on a number of issues you heard in the introduction, from energy to public safety to education and public health and everything else. And now as California Secretary of State. So why Secretary of State of all things I could have run for to continue to serve? Because I realized that among the other responsibilities of a secretary, from registering businesses in California, campaign finance, and even maintaining the state's archives, that the most important job when it comes to our democracy is not just to ensure that elections are conducted appropriately, and that is pivotal, but if I can use this office as a platform to get more people to register and to get more people to vote, it's not just good for democracy. Let me give you a couple of statistics here. In California, when the year I was elected, November of 2014, only 42% of California voters turned out to vote. So what does that mean? That means 58% didn't. 58% of 17 million California registered voters. We ranked 43rd in the nation in turnout. That's not good. We got to do something about that. It gets worse. In California, there's another 7 million people who are eligible to vote but can't because they haven't registered. They're 18 years or older, they're citizens, they just haven't registered, and so they can't show up on election day and cast a ballot. Those are numbers, but let me ask you to think about something even more important. Who are they? Who is the 58%? Who is the 7 million plus? It's disproportionately communities of color, disproportionately lower income families, disproportionately you, young people. And it's the same trend throughout the country. And so when not everybody who's eligible registers, and when more people who are registered don't turn out and vote, we have an electorate and we have the results of an election that does not reflect the people. Doesn't reflect the people of our community, of our city, of our state, of our nation. And so together, regardless of your political party, regardless of your political thinking, you have to agree with me on this. The more people registering, the more people voting, the better for our country. And that's why I do what I do. And I know that's why you are here. Whether you're from California or from another state, regardless of what side of the aisle you may be on or what political candidate for which office you support, what you're doing is important for the health of our democracy, because the more people register, the more people vote, the better the people's will is reflected in city halls, in state capitals, and in Washington, D.C., and everywhere in between. So don't underestimate the power of what you're doing. And again, I know I'm preaching to the choir here because you're here for a reason. You're here because you want to be here. And you're already interested, and you're already active, and you're already engaged. But hopefully, through the experience and the training and the information you're getting here, you're going to be that much stronger of an organizer when you go home. And not just here in California next Tuesday, but in November, we're going to see significant improvement of registration rates and turnout rates, especially amongst young people. Because aren't you tired of that saying that you're the leaders of tomorrow? I'm looking at this room and I'm seeing the leaders of today. I'm seeing the leaders of today. So go home after this and prove me right. We have several months between now and this November, and celebrate your work, celebrate your victories, celebrate your accomplishments, because you're going to change the world. I just know it, and it starts with the work that you're going to do. Thank you all very, very much for having me. And let's... let's get to some of your questions. Here and then here. You. All right.
So you were talking about making sure that everyone has an opportunity to vote. And in your position, have you looked into allowing people to vote online or starting to do something so that people have access even if they're not able to physically get to the polls? And I know mail is an option, but have you looked into online voting at all?
Yeah. You know, it's... if it's not the second question I get asked everywhere I go, it's the first question I get asked everywhere I go. You know, what about online voting? What about internet voting? And someday, maybe that will come, but I don't think we're quite ready for it yet for two reasons. So I gave you the bad news and the good news. The reasons why I don't think we're ready for online or internet voting, most people will guess the first reason, right? Why shouldn't we vote online? Security, right? Security, is it hackable? This, this, and that, right? Talk to our friends at JP Morgan Chase and Home Depot and Target and the IRS, all the, you know, hacking happens. And we can't compromise the integrity of our elections. But the other one is equally important, privacy. You know, we know who votes, who's registered, who votes. We can even tell you who votes in person versus who votes by mail, but we can't tell who voted for who, right? Our ballot is secret. And the internet isn't built that way. So maybe an internet 3.0 or 4.0 can eventually get there. But that's not to say we shouldn't be thinking about how we make voting more convenient for people, because we've come a long way since the beginning of the nation, when most people worked in agriculture And the reason to have elections on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November is because it's after the harvest, after selling in the city, and you needed a day to get back home to the farm so that you're ready to vote by Tuesday, right? The world has changed since then, but how we conduct elections kind of hasn't. So I actually have a proposal before the legislature that was approved last year and one that's before the legislature for consideration this year. California became the second state in the nation to adopt what's known as automatic voter registration. So when you're applying for or renewing a driver's license or a state ID at our Department of Motor Vehicles, if you're eligible, we're going to just register you to vote in the process. Right? Oregon was the first, we're the second. Illinois may be doing it now. North Carolina, West Virginia, other states are doing it. So it's kind of catching on across the country. But that's just the registration part. So we think we're going to tackle that 7 million, a good chunk of it in the coming years through automatic registration. This year's proposal will change how we do elections because in California, you basically have two options. You can either vote by mail or you show up to that one designated place close to where you live between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. on election day, and that's it. I want to change it to anybody here from Colorado? All right, good delegation. How do elections work in Colorado? In Colorado, every voter automatically gets their ballot mailed to them 4 weeks before election day. And then you have options on how to get that ballot back. So surprise, surprise, since they made this shift, more people fill it out, more people mail it back in. But let's say you don't buy stamps anymore. There are some people who live that way. Every county establishes these ballot drop boxes throughout the county. So as you're driving around, going to school, going to work, you see one of these, you can drop your ballot off wherever and whenever is most convenient for you. In Denver, I know they even have these drive-through ballot drop-off stations, literally curbside. You don't even have to get out of your car. Just hand it to one of the county representatives and you're done. But if you're like my mom and you insist on going to vote in person, they have modernized polling places as we know them to what they call voter assistance centers. So you can come to any location in the county, because instead of being greeted by a big notebook that has a printed list of names, they have laptops and tablets and access to the entire voter list. So as a voter, I can go anywhere in the county that's convenient for me to go vote, and I can go on election day, or I can go for a week to 2 weeks leading up to the election. So just think of options of when, where, and how to vote, most convenient being by mail, and their turnout is way up. Colorado's now third in the nation in turnout. Third, 43rd. We got a lot to learn from them, and that's what I'm suggesting that we do here in California. But we do have online registration, so we are using technology to the best of our ability. Yes?
It's just a thought, and it's something I'm going to, after I've talked to some people here, I'm going to bring up when I get home in Ohio. But what about starting a mobile voting station where if people are destitute, they don't have transportation, can't even afford bus lines. What if there was a mobile unit that could come into those neighborhoods and allow people to come out and vote that way?
Right. No, and that's a great idea, and I'm proud to say in California, we're starting to do some of that already. A couple of counties have. Do you guys ever, I don't know if they still have these anymore. When I was a kid, the library sometimes would have a bookmobile. Right, that kind of went out to different schools, different communities. If you couldn't get yourself to a library, well, why not a vote mobile, right? And so there are some counties in California that already have this. And as we're talking about changing how we do elections and creating vote centers in California, you know, some of the local elections officials have said, well, it's great to have designated locations that people can go to for a week or two. We want to have at least a handful in each county locations that are mobile, because if there's a big fair going on or a big, you know, event going on, let's go to where the people are, not just wait for the people to come to us. And so that's kind of being built into the proposal. All right, here, and then I'll work my way back here.
So my name is Sarah, I go to UC Berkeley.
All right, go Bears.
Yeah, go Bears. This is Sarah Funes from UC Berkeley. I saw you at Barbara Lee's event that day. And I've been trying to work within the administration at UC Berkeley to get a voting holiday passed. It was unanimously voted down, but one of the professors did mention, well, the federal government should do this, which I thought was ironic, because we got no votes in favor of it. What about creating a state holiday so that people can vote on election day.
I get that asked that question a lot too, and it sounds good. Can imagine the complexities of creating another holiday, and are schools open or closed, our businesses open or closed, and does our economy take a hit, this and that. Another recommendation I get is, why don't we move elections or voting from Tuesday to Monday or to Saturday, right? Do it over the weekend. It's convenient for more people, but maybe inconvenient for other people. And so that's why I think this proposal of doing, you know, 2 weeks worth of voting, you know, through real in-person early voting, in addition to voting by mail, which is even more convenient, kind of addresses it all. Because if Tuesday works for you, you have that option. If Saturday works for you, you can have that option. You know, if doing it by mail or dropping it off somewhere works better for you, you have that option. It's all about choices and options, not moving it from one day to another. So let's move back here. Young lady in the white, and then the gentleman in the blue, and then the gentleman in the back with the glasses. Yes, right here.
Thank you for sharing your story with all of us. I wanted to know what your biggest obstacle has been as Secretary of State.
My biggest obstacle as Secretary, I think there's two that come to mind. I mean, every job that I've had, I'm always full with these ideas, and we should do this, and we should do that. And it's not even like there's not enough money for everything, although that's a big challenge in government. But, you know, there's not enough time in the day, right? California is a big state, 58 counties, 40 million population. I'm just one person. So how can I get everywhere and do it all and still, you know, see my kids and, you know, have a good family life as well? So just kind of that balancing act. You know, file that away, by the way, whether you end up in public service or in the private sector or teaching, whatever you do in life, you know, balance and time management is critically important. But I think officially as Secretary, you know, I started off at a low point, right? When I got elected 43rd in the nation in turnout, 42% turnout, we have a lot of work to do. And so I've gone to the legislature with these ideas and requests for funding, but I'm up against a lot of other competing priorities too. So I think in every legislature and every level of government, there's that challenge for resources and political priority. Thankfully, the legislature has been pretty supportive. And our governor, Jerry Brown, once upon a time, he used to be the Secretary of State. So I think he knows what I'm going through. And they've been fairly supportive. Have I gotten everything I want? No. Have I gotten the most important things? Yes. So make sure your priorities are clear is a good challenge too. Yeah, you in the blue.
Hi, my name is Pratham Janeja, and I'm representing the University of Notre Dame. And often when we think about voting, especially in the United States, we think about it as like an apathy problem, and that like people aren't civically engaged. But you talked a little bit about the policy behind it and how preventing people from voting is also a pretty serious issue. And I know political scientists are like always talking about like which one it is. Is it a cultural thing, or is it that like we don't have policies in place to make that easy? So if you had to choose between the two and say like what is the priority, should we be working to fix policy problems, or should we be working to encourage people to get into voting? Which of the two do you see is the most important?
I think getting more people into voting is at the root the way to affect public policy, right? As I mentioned in my remarks, when we can get more people registered, more people voting, the electorate better reflects the people. So then who gets elected and the political messages or the mandates that people feel when they get elected, I think are gonna better reflect the people too. So what becomes the priority or the agenda in the nation's capital, in the state capital, and in, you know, cities around the country, better reflect the people. So, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks. So I've been in public office for a long time, and, you know, I can't tell you how many reports and studies are sent to my office all the time on healthcare, on education stats, on employment figures or wages or air quality or water quality, like you name it. And in most good reports, there's always good maps of where it's impacted, and you see big red dots and little red dots, and, you know, this and that. And then one day I was sitting there with a kind of voter trends book, right? And where registration rates are high and registration rates are low and turnout rates are high and low. And I'm like, wait a minute, this map looks familiar. And you start comparing all these maps, and there's these huge overlaps between, I said it earlier, high rates of type 2 diabetes. You know, raise your hand if you know somebody that has diabetes in this audience, right? Most people. Or, you know, where are the schools that are underperforming, not overperforming? Where are the areas that have bad infrastructure, right? In most places, it overlaps with communities that have lower registration rates and voting rates. So I do think getting more people engaged and active, not just on election day, but after people get into the habit of voting, maybe we can get them in the habit of, you know, parents being active in your kid's school, or being active in City Hall in planning and land use decisions or budget decisions, or even making your voice heard in the state capitol when they're considering all these legislations. The more people are just active in their community, I think good things happen in those areas. So that civic participation is the root of just a healthier society. All right, let's go back there with the glasses and then across the aisle here to the lady in the gray t-shirt.
I had the opportunity last year to talk to Secretary of State for my state, Tennessee, Trey Hargett, about a lot of things going on with voter registration. And one of the biggest questions I had was, why not, as public universities, are we not allowed for our student IDs to be used as a form of photo ID when we go to the registration?
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking, what did he say?
I unfortunately gave the politician answer and kind of danced around it a little bit, talking about how his, I guess his campaign and his administration is trying to do a lot of things, pushing things like people voting and coming to like events and stuff like that. But a lot of college students I know within my area don't have access to things like transportation when they're away at school. So getting registered is hard for them.
What was your name again?
Denzel Fitzgerald. I'm from Carson Newman University in Tennessee.
All right. If it's okay with you, I'm going to tell them that I met you today. And I've met Trey at conferences. There's a National Association of Secretaries of State. So we get together a couple times a year, talk policy and kind of what's going on. So I do know Trey. So here's a question that doesn't just apply to Tennessee. You know, we hear across the country of different states kind of changing their laws, changing their rules on how people can be registered or what it takes to register and how people are able to vote. You know, easier or frankly more difficult. And some of the things that we've heard, the two that kind of rise to the top that I've observed are number one, a reduction or elimination of early voting, right? So a lot of states were required because of voting rights violations years and years ago to not just have voting on election day, but have it be possible for voters to vote for several days, maybe a couple of weeks leading up to election day, so you create more convenience. And in recent years, especially since the Supreme Court took out a section of the Voting Rights Act, there are states that are reducing or eliminating that early voting opportunity. The other one I've heard a lot about is this voter ID. You know, it was the case for a long time. You didn't need an ID to go vote. When you registered, you know, you have to be a citizen. You have to be over the age of 18. But you weren't required to show an ID at a polling place, and certain states wanted to start requiring that. Why? What's the problem that you're trying to solve? Oh, voter fraud, right? You hear a lot about voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. We got to prevent voter fraud. Voter fraud is nearly non-existent, all right? So was it a problem in need of a solution, or was it a solution in search of a problem? If you're really wondering, let's dive a little bit deeper into this conversation. Voter ID, you have the state of Alabama, for example, where they pass a law requires you to show an ID at a polling place. Not everybody has an ID. Maybe most people do, but not everybody does. And within a couple of months of the legislature passing this voter ID law, they also cut off funding and shut down the DMV offices in only the parts of the state with the highest percentages of the African American population. I don't know. You ask yourself, is that a coincidence or not? Or is there an agenda behind the voter ID law? I'll give you another example. Texas, North Carolina, and I'm not sure if this is Tennessee or not, but when they pass a voter ID law, they're listing out what IDs qualify to be able to go vote. Driver's license, yeah. Passport, yeah. Gun permit, yeah. A state university student ID, no. So if they say, well, it's a state-issued ID, right? When you go to the airport, you need to have a state-issued ID. Well, state university is a state university, and if they gave me an ID, it's a state-issued ID. Why doesn't that count? That's a great question to ask those legislators, those governors, and those secretaries. We don't have voter ID in California. All right, where do we go next? It was the lady right here across the aisle in the gray.
Earlier you mentioned automatic voter registration at the DMV and things like that, but research has shown that voters who are automatically registered at the DMV are far less likely to actually turn out to vote than voters who are registered at voter registration drives or seek out registration on the internet, et cetera. So with, having automatic DMV voter registration would very likely increase the numbers of overall voters. Do you have a plan to turn those registered voters into actual voters on election day?
Yes, I love this question. a few things. You know, and you kind of referenced part of it towards the end. While we may actually increase the number of voters, you know, there's a lot of people that may not vote. To me, anything and everything gets more people voting is the good thing, right? So the registration rate, the turnout rate overall may go down because you have so many more voters that are registered. But the point is, if you get more people voting, that's good, right? So that's my starting point, number one. Number two, we don't have very much history. Oregon was the first state in the nation to adopt automatic registration. And this is the first election cycle. So they're now just now doing numbers on all the people who are automatically registered. Are they voting at higher rates or lower rates or the same? We just don't know. I can tell you this. If you're eligible to vote in the United States today, but you're not registered, you do not receive the voter information guide from the state. If you're eligible to vote in the United States of America today, but you're not registered, your county does not send you the sample ballot that tells you what's on the ballot and where to go and from what time to go vote on election day. So just by sheer virtue of automatically registering people, they're on the list and they're going to get the voter information guide. They're going to get the sample ballot. They're going to get what I call the invitation to democracy party. And it's a fun party. So now all those people finally get the information. Hey, there's an election coming up. Here's what we're voting on and here's where to go to vote. Go vote. That they never got that before, even though they were eligible to vote. Another thing, just politically, right? Campaigns right now tend not to talk to people who aren't registered. Why? If they're not registered, they can't vote. We gotta focus our money to send mail or to knock on the doors of, you know, people who are registered. And so all of a sudden, if you're on the list, candidates and campaigns, you're gonna be talking to them. I actually got a lot of pushback when we were suggesting to the legislature that we do automatic registration because political consultants who think they have a secret formula on how to win elections all of a sudden are like, whoa, wait a minute. There's more people we're going to have to talk to. And I would say, yeah, that's a good thing. But also think about this. Think about whether it's government, right, the states, the counties, whether it's nonprofit organizations, there's Rock the Vote, League of Women Voters, maybe even efforts on campuses to register students. All that time, the energy, the resources that we today put into voter registration. Imagine if registration almost took care of itself and you can take a lot of that money, all that time, energy, and resources and put that into voter education and voter turnout, right? That's kind of what we're setting up here. So we're not going to automatically register everybody overnight, but over several years, we'll take a good percentage of it and people are automatically on the rolls and we can shift, again, their time, energy, and resources to informing people and getting them to the polls.
My name is Jessica Hastings. I'm from Weber State University out in Ogden, Utah. We just started going into the vote-by-mail ballot process. The first year we did vote-by-mail ballot, we had a 33% voter turnout, which was the lowest we've had in a little while. And I'm currently working on several campaigns that we're educating people on vote-by-mail. And our biggest issue is when we go and knock on doors to remind them about their mail-in primary ballots, is we'll get a mom that answers the door, and she'll say, I have to ask my husband who we're voting for. And this is just a Utah thing, but do you have any advice on a way to kind of educate those spouses that aren't really politically active and they just kind of let their spouse vote for them?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think in California, you'll get at least equal, if not the opposite reaction of I think I need to talk to my wife about who we're supporting. Right, so that's a kind of a societal, cultural thing. I can think of the following. I mean, when you make a shift from one way of doing elections to another, there's a lot of public awareness that's required, right? Because if you shift from being able to vote in person primarily or only to voting by mail primarily or only, you got to make sure people know that things are changing, because we pay close attention because we're really interested in this stuff. But not everybody does. Not everybody watches CNN every day like I do. And so we got to make every effort to let people know, hey, we're going to be changing how things are done. Look for the ballot in the mail. This and that. And so when Colorado has made all these reforms and they're now doing so well, it was over a series of cycles with a lot of public information going on. And you can't put too much information for voters out there. That's a big part of it. The other thing I'd suggest is that's why I'm not a believer. Anybody here from Oregon or Washington, raise your hands. All right, so in those states, it's all vote by mail only. And people have suggested to me, why doesn't California do what Oregon and Washington are doing? They have high turnout rates too, and because they've gone to all vote by mail. And I think, look, vote by mail works for a lot of people. It doesn't get more convenient than that. In California, more than 60% of ballots that came in 2014 were by mail. So on the natural, we're already moving in that direction. But I think some people may choose different. Some people like getting it in the mail, but then dropping it off in person because they don't know about the post office. And then I told you about my mom. She's like, don't talk to me about vote by mail. I want to go in person. I think she likes to schmooze and socialize with the workers. But she wants that in-person experience and to see the neighbors and to see all that stuff. So I think we can and should be providing options for voters, not just one. Over here in the green. All right, this is going to be the last question.
Hi, I'm Cameron. Cameron Dunbar. I go to Oberlin College. I know earlier you mentioned civic participation as being kind of the root to society and kind of like the root of democracy. And I know California, almost a year ago, I think, like restored voting rights to low-level felons who are no longer serving time or on parole. So I was wondering, do you think that if voting is a right, that there should be any sort of state disenfranchisement ever?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And another one where every state has slightly different rules or laws. So I'll kind of explain by example what we're doing here in California. In California, state law was pretty clear, and this was actually a vote of the people a few decades ago, where they said, everybody has the right to vote if you're 18 years or older and a citizen, with a couple of exceptions. Number one, if a court deems you to be mentally incompetent, then your right to vote is suspended. And number two, if you're convicted of a felony and are serving time in state prison, and by extension, if you're convicted of a felony and you're on parole for that felony conviction, you lose the right to vote. But they were also very clear that once your time served is done, once you're out of state prison because your time is up, once you're off parole because your time is up, your voting rights in California are restored. In other states, one felony conviction, you're barred forever, permanently from voting. In some states, convicted of a felony, you can have your rights restored. When your time is done, you have to petition the governor, or there's some sort of process for applying for it and making the case for why you should be able to vote again. That's usually very, 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 very difficult. In California, the people of California said, no, once your time is done, it's only fair, your voting rights are restored, you have to re-register again, but you can start voting again. And there's also a big difference. A felony conviction, more serious crimes, versus misdemeanors. So even in California, if you're convicted of a misdemeanor, and maybe you're serving some time in county jail or something, or you're on probation, which is different than parole, you can actually still stay registered and keep voting. And so in California, because of an overcrowded prison population and some budget problems, the governor kind of did some reform to the system and created something that's lesser than parole. For people who are deemed to be lower risk or for lower level offenses, they created this community supervision category in California that's more like probation than parole, but it's people who are no longer in state prison for that felony conviction. And some people asked a previous Secretary of State, well, for folks who are in this community supervision category, do they have a right to vote? And at the time, the interpretation was, well, it's close enough to parole or being in state prison that no, they can't. And some voting rights activist organizations sued the state of California and won that the folks in community supervision should have the right to vote because they're not in state prison anymore. The law is clear about that. They're not on parole at all. The law is very clear about that. And so when I came in as secretary, we read the law. It's pretty black and white to us. And so we dropped the appeal of that court case. But I did so for two reasons. I know I'm going long here, but it's two very important reasons. Number one, from a voting rights standpoint, the law was very clear who's eligible to vote, who's not. And this group of folks who are no longer in state prison and they're not on parole, the law's pretty clear. They have the right to register and they have the right to vote. But the other reason, just to show you I'm being thoughtful about my decisions here, there's a growing body of evidence. State of Florida, Department of Corrections, U.S. Department of Justice, and elsewhere, that people who, after they're done serving their time, live in a jurisdiction where it is difficult or impossible to have your voting rights restored, they reoffend at higher rates than people who live in a jurisdiction where they have their rights restored or are more easily restored. They recommit crimes at lower rates. So the evidence was pretty clear. It's the right thing to do, both from a voting rights standpoint and from a public safety standpoint. All right, great questions, you guys. I am optimistic about your work in November. Thank you for having me.
We want to thank Secretary Padilla very much. And in the spirit of what we've been doing for the past day, maybe we can get a group with the secretary, if he's game for it.
It's like a selfie with the entire group.
Absolutely. All right. We're going to have secretary stand right there in the middle, and you guys kind of bunch towards the middle.
My only condition is if you post, you have to tag me, okay?
All right.
This is Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu, here at Dominican University of California at College Convention. That's #ColleGeDebate16.